Australian flames. The country is in the grip of the worst forest fires in its history. Murderous fires, as already over 100 people have been killed, according to a provisional estimate. Scorching temperatures reaching 47 degrees Celsius, with violent winds provoking a firestorm.
Conditions are some of the worst in living memory. A combination of scorching weather, drought, and tinder dry bush. On Saturday, temperatures in Melbourne soared to 46.4 degrees Celsius, the highest on record.
The death toll continues to rise from one of Australia's worst wildfires in history.
Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. While governments try to stall a global financial crash, the bankrupt atmosphere continues to erupt in fast death by fire and creeping bands of deserts. The green Eden of species is emptying itself, the purge of climate shift. In this program, you'll hear one of Australia's top climate scientists on the deadly fires there and the forces that confront all of us, including here in North America. From Adelaide, Professor Barry Brook shares his valuable time with EcoShock listeners. I'll follow that up with an audio montage of growing deserts as warming pushes out the rainfall, exactly as Sir James Lovelock and the Hadley Center predicted. The American Southwest is falling into the same drying pattern as Australia, with the same fire risks. As you may have heard, Obama's new Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, told the Los Angeles Times on February 4th, that agriculture may end in California by the end of this century. The snowpack in the Sierra Mountains, source of the rivers feeding California's irrigation, may fall by 90% due to global warming unless we find a way to stop it. California is the largest provider of vegetables, fruits, and other food stocks to the United States and to Canada. Secretary Chu also wondered whether the major cities of California are sustainable at all. Chu told the Times, quote, I don't think the American public has gripped in its gut what could happen. We're looking at a scenario where there's no more agriculture in California. I don't actually see how they can keep their cities going. Wow, that's right from the top. Southern Australia is having the same problems, but their catastrophe is more advanced, as you will hear next. Lots to do, so let's get going to Australia, the warning to the world.
This is what used to be the main street of Marysville. What didn't burn simply melted.
The death toll from Australia's worst fire in a quarter of a century continues to rise.
Raging wildfires brought devastating deaths to Australia in the southern state of Victoria. The conflagration followed 3 days of sweltering, record-breaking heat. We wonder, could this be a warning about our future as climate change proceeds? Let's find out more about what is happening to Australia's climate with Professor Barry Brook. He's one of Australia's top young climate scientists and director of the Research Institute for Climate Change and Sustainability at the University of Adelaide. Barry, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Our time together is kind of limited, so let's get right to the point. Are sudden heat waves and the following fires, are they what we would expect from climate change?
They're certainly what we would expect. These are extreme events, and as you change the average weather, then you change the extremes as well. And they get distorted such that events that were once very rare or never occurred can become quite common, even with what is apparently a small change in the average. So the heat waves that Australia has experienced in January and February of 2009 is extraordinary in the sense that it's very long and it's also the hottest heat wave on record, coming on top of a very dry drought.
It's strange for us because we picture that heat wave in the south, and yet there are storms, violent storms with flooding in the north. What has changed for Australia's climate and why?
Well, certainly a consistent prediction of climate science is that we should get more extreme weather in all its forms, not just heat waves, but also precipitation events. There's more energy in the climate system now than there was in the past. So it's able to evaporate more water from the surface and from the oceans, which dries out the landscape and makes it more prone for fire. Also creates the conditions where you can have record-breaking floods as well as heat waves. So these extreme events, whilst they've occurred in the past, are consistent with what we would expect with climate change in terms of them becoming more frequent. So I think this is a major concern, that what we're seeing in Australia are the sort of events that are predicted to be common in the next 50 years, well, they're apparently becoming common even as we speak. So that is perhaps one indication that the rate of change in the climate system is at the upper end of what predictions such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change may have anticipated.
And people talk about adapting to climate change. We've already seen Australian farmers abandon long-held property for lack of water, and now it seems like just living in a well-treated area might be dangerous. Is the only possible adaptation perhaps to abandon parts of the country in the long run? Do you think that's taking it too far? I mean, think about Secretary Stephen Chu now in the U.S. He suggested that agriculture might end in California.
I think what will certainly end is wasteful practices. And Australia's agriculture has been characterised by a waste of water. Australia is a very dry continent, so agriculture is difficult in many parts, and we've been dependent on irrigated agriculture from a couple of our large river systems. But on a per capita basis, because Australia is so sparsely populated, there's actually still a lot of water. Australia's in the top third of all countries for available water. So it's been a poor use of water that's caused devastation in these river systems, an over-allocation of water for irrigation, and all of these problems. Now, in the case of California, climate change is going to lead to a major shortage of water at certain key times. For instance, in summer, when the rivers were fed by snowpack melt, that is going to decline dramatically, and that will mean that what was once reliable stream flows will no longer be the case. There is scope for adaptation in all of these changes. We can look at more water-efficient agriculture, for instance. We can look at changing where we grow certain crops and where we undertake pastoral agriculture. But it's going to be a major challenge that means business as usual, and what we have come to expect as being a productive landscape will not necessarily be that way, even within the next few decades.
Dr. Brooks, you've also promised part two of your article, How Much Warming is in the Pipeline. I have to admit, I haven't found it yet, and I can't wait. How much warming is developing, even if we stopped all these greenhouse gases?
A major problem is that there are two big effects people are having on the climate system. One of them is a warming effect from CO2 and other greenhouse gases. But the other, which is somewhat balancing this, is a cooling effect from low-level tropospheric aerosols. These are pollutants such as sulfates that come from coal-fired power stations and vehicle emissions. A city like LA, for instance, is a classic example of the low-lying haze and smog. That's a dimming effect that causes less sunlight to reach the surface than otherwise would. And globally, that has a cooling effect on the climate. The worst situation is in Asia, where there's a lot of fires which burn animal dung, and of course a lot of new coal-fired power stations that are not capturing their sulfate emissions. All of this adds up to a cooling effect on the climate that may be as high as about half of the warming effect that we would otherwise have expected. Now, if you get rid of all of the dung burning and vehicle emissions and coal-fired power stations that will be required to stop the ongoing build-up of greenhouse gases, and you also remove the major source of that cooling effect, all that comes to a head when we talk then about how the climate is going to rebalance itself. And the best evidence is we've got about 2 to 2.5 degrees of warming in the pipeline. So if we shut off all greenhouse gas emissions now, because we're also shutting off aerosol emissions, we've got a lot more warming on the way.
I was wondering if even the current economic crisis might cause enough factories to shut down and enough people to drive less that perhaps we might see a slight increase in warming just from that reduction.
I think that's a very likely hypothesis. It's been speculated that the global financial crisis may cause almost certainly will cause a reduction in the amount of greenhouse gases going in the atmosphere because of reduction in industries. But that's a long-term effect. That takes years and decades to accumulate its effect in terms of warming, as it's happened in the last 50 years. But as soon as those factories stop producing sulfate aerosols, that's all washed out of the atmosphere within weeks. And so that's a very rapid effect. So I agree with you strongly that the net effect of the economic downturn is likely to be an extra pulse of warming rather than cooling, even if in the long term it has a slight cooling effect on the planet in terms of fewer greenhouse gases being released each year.
We do live in an ironic universe. If we clean up, it might actually hurt us in the short run. I'm thinking, too, about the situation in Australia. There's less media coverage of heat deaths, but heat deaths definitely do go up along with these spikes in the temperature, obviously.
Heat deaths are important. People get stressed in times when they can't cool down, so when there's extended hot periods. Now, in the past, a lot of people have died in severe heat waves because they've had no access to air conditioning. That was the situation in Europe in that extreme summer of 2003, when it was about 5 degrees hotter than the average, and there were certain times when Europe got up to over 40 degrees Celsius, which is over 100 Fahrenheit. So these are very stressful times. In areas where people can't adapt, can't essentially burn extra greenhouse gases by switching on air conditioner, they will suffer more. And so we're likely to see more heat-related deaths in areas of the world that are heating up at least as rapidly as the developed world, but have no access to forms of adaptation that can actually allow you to cool down. And, of course, as we've seen in Australia, when you get persistent hot, dry weather and hot, dry winds coming in off the continent, which are drawn out of the continent by unusual weather systems, that's what creates tinderbox conditions that allows wildfires to erupt, and that's what happened in southern Australia, where we've had over 170 people killed in the wildfire events that followed the extreme heat wave of February 2009. These are the sort of dramatic events that are going to increase in frequency as the climate continues to warm and become more energetic.
Well, you know, whether we're scientists or not, it's going to be tough to watch some of these events and deaths increasing. I wonder, what's your personal reaction to these tragedies?
I think we have to make sure that the suffering of people involved in these tragedies, the damage caused, are not in vain. In other words, that we recognize these as the major warning signals, the flashing red light saying we've got to do something to avoid even more disastrous events occurring in the future, because it's quite clear that on our current business as usual pathway, these events will become appallingly regular. And it will reach the point that in many places we simply can't adapt. Too many people are being killed by climate change. Too many areas are becoming uninhabitable. And the world as we know it will be totally transformed. We're not at that point right now, or at least I think the balance of probability is that we're not at that point. But it does suggest that we have to move into emergency mode, change our energy supplies to those that don't release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, be more sensible about how we live with a more dynamic climate system in terms of adapting with our agriculture, the way we build cities and houses, the way we treat the natural environment. These are major lessons of which we're only seeing the first portends of a very dark future. Now, we can avoid that, much like Scrooge in the Dickens tale of the Christmas Carol, witnessing the ghosts and avoiding a dark future. We can do the same, but we have to listen to the ghosts. And things like the heat wave and the bushfires that have occurred in Australia this year, Hurricane Katrina a few years ago, these are the ghosts telling us to avoid a dark future.
We've been talking with Professor Barry Brook. He holds the Sir Hubert Wilkins Chair of Climate Change at the University of Adelaide. As we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add for our North American listeners?
I guess I'm very excited about the new administration in the US and the fact that they've appointed people with strong scientific credentials who recognize the seriousness of this problem. I've been talking a lot about potential solutions on my blog, and people are welcome to come and visit there as well to hear more of my thoughts on climate change and energy solutions. And the web address for that is bravenewclimate.com.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Professor Brook, thank you so much for helping us out.
That's a pleasure.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco.
It seems to have moved north up the coast.
Sacre bleu! I cannot believe Mother Nature would do such a terrible thing.
Might be what's behind this creeping desert business.
Mayhem! Mask!
What's the point coming all this way? Making deserts in a day.
We used to listen to some scientists predicting that the Mediterranean may become a desert in some decades from now. And we were thinking that this is in the sphere of science fiction. But it seems, from all the reports that are coming through, that this may be a reality if we don't take urgent steps. On the sphere of natural disasters emanating from these climatic changes, we have witnessed last year devastating forest fires in southern Mediterranean, in Greece, in Portugal, in Italy, in France. And the same thing applies to Northern African or Middle Eastern countries.
What's the use, Mother Nature say, making deserts in a day?
The Kumtag is China's sixth largest desert, and state media reports it is creeping closer and closer to the city of Dunhuang in China's far west, creeping at a rate of between 1 and 4 meters each year. 90% of the city has already surrendered to desertification. This highlights a growing problem in China. Large tracts of land in the country's arid western provinces are turning from farmlands into deserts.
Someone out there's playing a deadly game. Cutting down a wounded land in pain.
Environmentalist Chen Ji-chun says now it is nearly an irreversible process.
It's hard to restore the original vegetation because there is very little water. You cannot plant anything where there is no water.
China's State Forestry Administration says the advance of the desert results in a direct annual loss of billions of dollars, while threatening the livelihoods of some 400 million people.
There's a hole in the sky where the sun gets through, burning every which way, from the top to the bottom of the food chain to in the middle of the desolate plain. What's the point coming on?
Climate change causing desertification in Mongolia. The climate in Mongolia has become more extreme, with summer droughts, harsh winters, dust storms and blizzards. Dr. Punsalma Batima, a member of the Nobel Prize-winning International Panel on Climate Change, leads a government project on improving water management in Mongolia. She described the growing climate hazards that the semi-arid country has already begun to face.
There's also a number of IPCC reports recognize that the mountainous and semi-arid region is very vulnerable to climate change, and Mongolia also facing the same situation. It's really very dangerous because when very extreme precipitation is increased and mild precipitation is decreased, and you know the land and soil cannot get sufficient moisture, you know the vegetation and the ecosystem is degrading.
What's the use, Mother Nature say, making deserts in a day?
These people are members of the Pul tribe, nomads and herders by tradition. They've lived on the fringes of the desert for centuries, but each year the desert spreads, and places that used to be semi-arid are now too dry to support them. Most have now given up their nomadic ways. Life has been reduced to little more than an endless search for water, a problem made worse by the large herds of animals at the Pul keep. Not only must they find water for themselves, but for their animals as well. Being their only means of livelihood, the animals come first. And with the Sahara growing by thousands of square kilometers every year, this struggle for survival will only intensify.
There's a
the size of a grain of sand, dying every day. Now the time that we listened and we made a stand before it gets too late.
More than 800 wildfires are burning across Northern California today. A lightning storm, officials called unprecedented.
The wildfires burning in California aren't growing, but there is still no sign of relief yet. Northern California now has more than 1,400 fires, and a warning for extreme fire danger remains in effect for today.
What's the point coming all this way? Making deserts in a day. Making deserts in a day. What's the use, Mother Nature say? Making deserts in a day.
And I think the story is kind of bleak, potentially, for the Western United States. All right. Here's a picture that our colleague Craig Allen from the U.S. Geological Survey took in northwestern New Mexico in 2002 fall. These trees, it's fall, right? The trees should be changing color. No. These are pinyon pines. The reason they're changing color in this pinyon juniper woodland is because all of the pinyon pines over tens of thousands of square kilometers are dying. Or now, are dead. But this drought, which is the worst drought in the instrumental record, has killed a lot of trees, and it's not just in the pinyon juniper woodland. So the big deal here is that this drought is being made a lot worse, probably, by global warming. And that's the kind of situation we're going to have increasingly in the future, and you're going to see whole-scale landscape transformation as a result. We're going to see not only die-off of species and trees, we're going to see major wildfire, and we're going to see a change in vegetation that's adapting the landscape across the West to a warmer, drier reality.
The shock was so intense, they say they all got paralyzed. Sahara, we sympathize with you.
That song was Making Deserts in a Day by the Henry Gorman Band. You heard audio clips from correspondents to the Australian newspaper, plus the BBC, the Daily Telegraph, Voice of America, Arizona scientist Jonathan Overpeck, IRN, and UNEP. Green 960 AM in San Francisco and around the world at green960.com. You have been listening to the Radio EcoShock Show. Find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at the website ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock, like an electric shock, .org. Write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith saying thank you for listening, and do join us again next week.